Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. I'm your host, Darrell McClain, and let's get into our episode.
Simply search for the T-Bone and Chick Brew podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are sold.
The Darrell McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. You can get a membership for as little as $3 a month at www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcClain Show.
We talk about a lot of serious topics on this show. One very serious topic is women's health. One company that stood out to me was VSlay.com because the owner is very transparent about her own struggles in the women's health department and has great customer service, great deals, and frequent sales. You can check her out, her great customer service, products about women's health, and frequent sales at www.VSlay.com. That is www.VSlay.com.
Behold, that row and Casey must be overruled, end quote. That comes from Justice Alito as he writes in an initial majority draft circulated inside the court. The Supreme Court has voted to overturn abortion rights, drafts of an opinion show. Now, the Supreme Court voted to strike down the landmark Roe v. Wade decision according to initial draft majority opinion written by Justice Samuel Alito, circulated inside the court, and obtained by Politico. The draft opinion is a full-throated, unflinching repudiation of the 1973 decision which guaranteed federal constitutional protections of abortion's right and subsequent the 1992 decision, Planned Parenthood v. Casey. The largely maintained that the right Roe was egregiously wrong from the start, Alito writes. We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled, he writes, in the document labeled as the opinion of the court. It is time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives, end quote. Now, deliberations on controversial cases have in the past been fluid. Justices can and sometimes do change their votes as draft opinions circulate, and major decisions can be subject to multiple drafts and vote trading, sometimes until just days before the decision is unveiled. The court's holding will not be final until it is published, likely in the next 2 months. The immediate impact of the ruling as drafted in February would be the end of a half-century guarantee of federal constitutional protection of abortion rights and allow each state to decide whether to restrict or ban abortion. It is unclear if there has been subsequent changes to the draft. No draft decision in modern history of the court has been so disclosed publicly while a case was still pending. The unprecedented revelation is bound to intensify the debate over what was already the most controversial case on the docket this term. Now, the draft opinion offers an extraordinary window into the justices' deliberation in the most consequential case before the court in the last 5 decades. Some sort of watchers predicted that the conservative majority would slice away at abortion rights without flatly overturning the 49-year-old precedent. The draft shows that the court is looking to reject Roe's logic and legal protection. Quote, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak and the decision has had damaging consequences. And as far as from the beginning about the national settlement of the abortion issue, Roe and Casey have inflamed the debate and deepened the divisions, end quote from Justice Samuel Alito in the initial draft and majority opinion. A person familiar with the court's deliberations said that the four of the other Republicans appointed, Justice Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, had voted with Alito in the conference held among the justices after hearing oral arguments in December, and that lineup remains unchanged as of this week. Now, the three Democrats appointed, Justices Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, are working on one or more dissents, according to the person. How Chief Justice John Roberts will ultimately vote and whether he will join an already written opinion or drafts his own is unclear. Now, the document labeled as the first draft of the majority opinion includes a notation that it is circulated among the justices on February 10th. If the Alito draft is adopted, it will rule in favor of Mississippi in the closely watched case over the state's attempt to ban most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Roberts confirmed the authenticity of the draft opinion and said he was ordering an investigation into the disclosure. Quote, to the extent this betrayal of the confidence of the court was intended to undermine the integrity of our operations, it will not succeed. The work of the court will not be affected in any way, Roberts pledged in a written statement. This was a singular and egregious breach of the trust that is an affront to the court and the community of public servants who work here. Now, Roberts also stressed that the draft opinion does not represent a decision by the court or the final position of any member on the issue in this case. The court's spokesperson has declined to comment pre-publication. Now, Politico received a copy of the draft opinion from a person familiar with the court's proceedings in the Mississippi case, along with other details supporting the authenticity of the document. The draft opinion runs 98 pages, including 31-page index of a historical state abortion laws. The document is replete with citations to previous court decisions, books, and other authorities, and includes 118 footnotes. The appearances and timing of the drafts are consistent with court practices. The disclosure of Alito's draft majority opinion, a rare breach of Supreme Court secrecy, and the tradition around its deliberation comes as all sides in the abortion debates are girding for the ruling. Speculation about the looming decision has been intense since the December oral arguments indicated a majority was inclined to support the Mississippi law. Now, under the longstanding court procedures, justices hold preliminary votes on cases shortly after argument and assign a member of the majority to write a draft of the court's opinion. The draft is often amended in consultation with other justices. In some cases, the justices change their votes altogether, creating the possibility that the current alignment on Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization could change. This chief justice typically assigns majority opinions when he is in the majority. When he is not, the decision is typically made by the most senior justice in that majority. Exceptionally weak, a George W. Bush appointee who joined the court in 2006, Alito's argues that the 1973 abortion rights ruling was an ill-conceived and deeply flawed decision that invented a right mentioned nowhere in the Constitution and unwisely sought to wrench the contentious issue away from political branches of government. Alito's draft ruling would overturn a decision by the New Orleans-based Fifth Circuit of Appeals that found Mississippi law afoul of the Supreme Court precedent by seeking to effectively ban abortions before viability. Now, Roe, survey of history ranged from the constitutional irrelevant to the blatantly incorrect. Alito continues, adding that his reasoning was exceptionally weak and that it originally decision had damaging consequences. The inescapable conclusion is that the right to abortion is not deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition, Alito writes. Alito approvingly quotes a broad range of critics of the Roe decision. He also points to liberal ICANN's such as the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, who at certain points in their careers took issue with the reasoning in Roe or its impact on the political process. Alito's skewering of Roe and the endorsement of at least four of the justices for the unsparing critique is also a measure of the court's rightward turn in the recent decades. Roe was decided 7-2 in 1973, with the five Republicans appointees joining two justices nominated by the Democratic presidents. The overturning of Roe was almost immediately led to stricter limits on abortion access in large swaths of the South and the Midwest, with about half of the states set to immediately impose broad abortion bans. Any state could legally allow the procedure. The Constitution does not prohibit the citizens of each state from regulating or prohibiting abortion, the draft concludes. Roe and Casey originated that authority. We now overrule those decisions and return that authority to the people and their elected representatives, end quote. Now, the draft contains this type of caustic rhetorical flourishes Alito is known for that has caused Roberts, his fellow, and Bush appointees some discomfort in the past. At times, Alito's draft opinion takes an almost mocking tone as it skewers the majority opinion in Roe, written by Justice Henry Blackburn and Richard Nixon, appointee who died in 1999. Roe expressed the feeling that the 14th Amendment was a provision that did the work, but its message seemed to be that the abortion right could be somewhere in the Constitution and that specifying an exact location was not of paramount importance, Alito wrote. Alito declares that the one central tenets of Roe viability distinction between fetus not capable of living outside the womb and those which can makes no sense. In several passages, he describes doctors and nurses who terminate pregnancies as abortionists. When Roberts voted with liberal justices in 2020 to block a Louisiana law imposing heavier regulations on abortion clinics, his solo concurrence used the more neutral term abortion providers. In contrast, Justice Clarence Thomas used the word abortionist 25 times in a solo dissent in the same case. Alito uses the phrase egregiously wrong to describe Roe's echoes language Mississippi Solicitor General Scott Stewart used in December in defending his state's ban on abortion after 16 weeks of pregnancy. The phrase was also contained in an opinion Kavanaugh wrote as part of a 2020 ruling that the jury's conviction in a criminal case must be unanimous. Now, in that opinion, Kavanaugh labeled two well-known Supreme Court decisions egregiously wrong when decided, the 1944 ruling upholding the detention of Japanese Americans during World War II, Carmusna versus United States, and the 1896 decision that blessed racial segregation under the rubric of separate but equal, Plessy versus Ferguson. Now, the High Court has never formally overturned Carmusna, but did repudiate the decision in 2018, ruling by Roberts that upheld the President Donald Trump's travel ban policy. Now, the legacy of Plessy versus Ferguson, Plessy remained the law of the land for nearly six decades until the court overturned it with the Brown v. Board of Education school desegregation ruling in 1954. Quoting Kavanaugh, Alito writes of Plessy, "It was egregiously wrong on the day it was decided." Alito's draft's opinion include in small type a list about two pages worth of decisions in which justices overruled prior presidents, in many instances reaching results praised by liberals.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It goes without saying that this show does not happen without listener support. Support the Darrell McClain Show by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for $3. Or you can go to buzzsprouts.com/the Darrell McClain Show and hit the subscribe button and join there. Many ways to donate to the show. Independent media that won't reinforce tribalism. We have one planet. Nobody is leaving. So let us reason together. www.patreon.com/the Darrell McClain Show or go to Buzzsprouts and to the Darrell McClain Show and subscribe. The implication that allowing states to overturn abortion laws is on par with ending legal racial segregation has been hotly disputed. But the comparison underscores the conservative justice's belief that Roe is so flawed that the justice should disregard their usual hesitation about overturning precedent and wholeheartedly renounce it. Alito's draft opinion ventures even further into this racially sensitive territory by overserving in a footnote that some earlier proponents of abortion rights also had unsavory views in favor of eugenics. Quote, some such supports have been motivated by the desire to suppress the size of the African-American population, Alito writes. It is beyond dispute that Roe has had a demographic impact and a highly disproportionate percentage aborted fetuses are black, end quote. Alito writes that by raising the point, he is casting aspersions on, he isn't casting aspersions on anyone. For one part, we do not question the motive of either those who have supported or those who have opposed the laws restricting abortion, he writes. Alito also addresses concerns about the impact of decisions could have on public discourse. Quote, we cannot allow our decisions to be affected by any extraneous influences such as concern about the public's reaction to our work, Alito writes. We do not pretend to know how our political system or society will respond to the day's overruling of Roe versus Casey, or Roe and Casey. And if we could foresee what will happen, we have no authority to let that knowledge influence our decision. Now, in the main opinion in the 1992 Casey decision, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, and Davis Soter warned that the court will pay a terrible price for overruling Roe, despite criticism of the decision from some in the public and legal community. Quote, while it has engendered disapproval, it has not been unworkable, the three justices wrote then. An entire generation has come of age free to assume Roe's concept of liberty in defining the capacity of a woman to act in society and to make reproductive decisions. No erosions of principles going into liberty or personal autonomy has left Roe's central holding of a doctrinal remnant, end quote. When Dobbs was argued in December, Robert seemed to out of sync with other conservative justices, as he had been a number of cases, including one challenging the Affordable Care Act. At the argument session last fall, Roberts seemed to be searching for a way to uphold the Mississippi's 15-week ban without completely abandoning the Roe framework. Quote, viability, it seems to me, doesn't have anything to do with choice. But if it really is an issue about choice, why is 15 weeks not enough time? Roberts asked during the arguments. The thing is that that issue is before us today is 15 weeks. Now, nods to conservative colleagues, while Alito's draft opinion doesn't cater much to Roberts' views, portions of it seem intended to address specific interests of other justices. One passage argues that social attitudes toward out-of-wedlock presidencies have changed drastically since the 1970s, and that increased demand for adoption makes abortion less necessary. These points dovetail with issues that Barrett, a Trump appointee and the court's newest member, raised at the December argument. She suggested laws allowing people to surrender newborn babies on a no-question-asked basis means carrying a pregnancy to term doesn't oblige one to engage in child rearing. Quote, why don't the safe haven laws take care of the problem, asked Barrett, who adopted two of her seven children. Much of Alito's draft is devoted to arguing that widespread criminalization of abortion during the 19th and the 20th century belies on the notion that the right to abortion is implied in the Constitution. The conservative justice attached to his draft a 31-page index listing laws passed to criminalize abortion during that period. Now, Alito claims, quote, an abortion tradition of prohibiting abortion on pain of criminal punishment from the earliest days of the common laws until 1973. Until the latter part of the 20th century, there was no support in American law for constitutional rights to obtain an abortion. Zero. None. No state constitutional provisions had recognized such right, Alito adds. Alito's draft argues that rights protected by the Constitution but not explicitly mentioned in it, so-called unenumerated rights, must be strongly rooted in U.S. history and tradition. This form of analysis seems at odds with several of the court's recent decisions, including many's rulings backing gay rights. Quote, we hold that Roe and Casey must be overturned. The Constitution makes no reference to abortion, and no such right is implicitly protected by any constitutional provisions. Now, liberal justices seems likely to take issue with Alito's assertion in the draft opinion that overturning Roe would not jeopardize other rights in the courts, and have grounded it in a privacy such as the rights to contraception, to engage in private consensual sexual activity, and to marry someone of the same sex. Quote, we emphasize that our decision concern to the constitutional right to abortion and no other right, Alito writes, nothing in this opinion should be understood to cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion. Alito's draft opinion rejects the idea that abortion bans reflect the subjugation of women in American society. Women are not without electoral or political power, he writes. The percentage of women who register to vote and cast ballots is consequently higher than the percentage of men who do so. The Supreme Court remains one of Washington's most secretive institutions, priding itself on protecting the confidentiality of its internal deliberations. Quote, at the Supreme Court, those who don't talk and those who talk don't know, Ginsburg was fond of saying. The tight-lipped reputation has eroded somewhat in recent decades due to a series of books by law clerks, law professors, and investigative journalists. Some of these authors clearly had access to draft opinions, such as the one obtained by Politico, but their books emerged well after the cases in question were resolved. The justices held their final arguments of the current term on Wednesday. The court has set a series of sessions over the next 2 months. The release of the rulings is still unresolved cases, including the Mississippi abortion case. So let me be very clear about this before I get into my real personal analysis. This says something to us that I have always known and has somewhat always said, and this is not about my personal opinions on the topic of abortions. But I want to say this as a fact. There is no right nor privilege in America that is permanent. Contrary to popular belief, and this may get me some pushback, there are no rights and privileges that stand automatically in perpetuity. Every generation has to fight the battles of the previous generation to sustain and keep what was won. That is something that is as foundational as a truth, if I know any. It is something that we know while pretending that we don't know. The oldest example is obviously the Plessy versus Ferguson decision that had been, until the time it was overturned by then Brown versus the Board of Education, that was legal precedent. That was a law of the land that was deeply rooted in American history for a long period of time, right up until the court decided that it wasn't. And all of a sudden, the rights to public education, etc., and everything that came with that existed. It had been history before. It had been the precedent before the opposite. And then all of a sudden, it was no longer true. It was very true until very recently, the 1964 and 1965 provisions of the Civil Rights Act. It was true, and it was settled law right up until it wasn't. And that work that the civil rights icons like Martin Luther King and Byron Rustin and Fannie Lou Hamer and Sally B. Mathis and Lorraine Hansberry and all the people, Sidney Poitier and Jesse Jackson and et cetera, had done, even though that had been on the books since 64 and 65. It became, you know, untethered when the courts decided it was no longer needed. In the same way, you have this particular abortion law, Roe v. Wade, that has been on the books for 49 years. 49 years people have, by the standard of the U.S. law, had legal access to abortions, and it was interpreted that that was a federal law that was found somewhere in the Constitution. And if this holds true, this opinion draft that was written in February, then 49 years of something that we have decided was law, this is older than me, will come undone and will be deemed as being no longer precedent, no longer the law of the land, no longer federally protected. There are 21 states that have already abortion triggers in them that they already have laws pre-written that if things change at the federal level, there are abortion laws that already are triggered and go into effect. There are 12 states that it happens overnight, and there are the rest of them have a time for their state Congress and Senate to meet and to work out the details. But that is kind of what this is leading to. And I have to go ahead and point out why the liberal justices are arguing that this is a bad thing, because if you can overturn a law that happened 49 years ago, if you can overturn a law that's been the precedent since 1964, if you can overturn a law that's been the precedent since 1965, then you can definitely overturn a Obergefell. All right, and that case was Obergefell versus Hodges. So you can definitely overturn that one, because that right, the right for same-sex couples to get married and to be legalized in all 50 states, that law did not come into effect until June 26 of 2015. So that is what I am just going to point out, that if this law stands, this ruling stands, then what I have said would be true. You need to understand that there is no such thing in the United States as a permanent right or privilege in perpetuity, and that every so-called right and our privileges are subject to reinterpretation, to changes. And we can debate amongst ourselves if that is a good thing and how we shall respond to that. I'm going to get into some of the analysis from some other people about what their thoughts on this before I give my final opinion.
Joining me now is John Meacham, historian and Rogers Distinguished Professor at Vanderbilt University. John, what is the long-term implication of this in terms of the court and in terms of the rule of law if 5 members now of the Supreme Court can overturn nearly a half century of constitutional precedent?
You know, Andrea, we're entering an unfolding crisis of trust. It's unclear what the implications will be, but I think we can speculate with some safety that an extraordinary number of Americans are going to see this as a startling and maybe they shouldn't be surprised, but they will be reversal of a half century of precedent. Now, precedents should not stand just because they're precedents, but as you just played, there has been an understanding in the country that the 1973 decision, or at least the rights secured by it, were secure. And, you know, one of the things we're going to have to deal with here is we're such a narrowly divided country. You know, we've only had 3 presidential elections since World War II, where a candidate got even as much as 60% of the vote. And we've been in an era where we're much closer, as we know, to having popular minority vote winners become president. And so we're narrowly divided. And if a narrowly divided court makes this sweeping of a decision, you're going to have an extraordinary number of people in the center and to the left of the spectrum. And I hesitate even to talk in those conventional terms, but for these purposes, in the center and to the left, believing that this was a political as opposed to a constitutional decision. And, you know, when Earl Warren led the court in 1953-54, announced in May of 1954, to the Brown versus Board of Education decision, he took care to make it a unanimous decision, 9-0. And so when big stuff happens, history tends to suggest that you don't have this on a 5-4 decision.
John Meacham, when we think about other constitutional rights that have been conferred in recent decades, and that includes Republican decisions as well, the right to marriage, that the majority opinion was Justice Kennedy, the mentor, of course, of Justice Kavanaugh on this court. What does this mean for the right to contraception? Because basically the privacy right undergirding Roe was Griswold in Connecticut, and that was the right to privacy. And then by extension, of course, the right to marriage. So what does this mean for LGBTQ rights?
I think everything is at risk. And, you know, people like me, and I don't want to drag you into this, but people who do what we do for a living often say that democracy is a fragile thing, that the Constitution is a fragile thing. Well, if you ever thought that was hyperbolic or a cliche or some sort of the casual thing, read this draft opinion. Elections matter. The court matters. The composition of the Senate matters. The presidency matters. Because in a republic, all rights are supposed to be eternal, right? They're supposed to be grounded in the both in reason and in a theocentric view. They're supposed to be eternal. But in practice, they're temporal. And what we're seeing today, in vivid terms, right where you're standing, is that the rights that many people have taken for granted for 50 years and more are fragile and at risk.
Dive right into the breaking news in a potentially groundbreaking shift in American constitutional law. The Supreme Court appears poised to strike down the landmark Roe v. Wade decision. According to a leaked draft opinion published last night by Politico, a majority of the Supreme Court is prepared to overturn the right to abortion. The leak of the 98-page document is unprecedented in the court's modern history. The draft opinion was reportedly authored by Justice Samuel Alito and circulated in February. Alito writes in part this: Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and the decision has had damaging consequences. It is time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives. NBC News has not obtained or been able to independently verify the authenticity of the document, and the Supreme Court has declined to comment. The final opinion is expected in late June or early July. Joe, so many different moving parts here, but overall, what does this story mean for the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, for the Supreme Court, in a word, illegitimacy. You know, the court's always been guided by the law, but it's also been keenly aware that as the only unelected branch of American government, they needed to not appear to be openly contemptuous of public opinion. That would be especially true today, given the GOP's might makes right approach to the sacking of Merrick Garland's nomination or the elevation of Donald Trump's final pick. One more thing. Look at this picture, Mika, from Madeleine Albright's funeral. The five Democratic politicians on the front row won the most votes in the presidential elections of 1992, 1996, 2000, 2008, 2012. 2016, and 2020. And yet, a half century of constitutional rights supported by over 70% of Americans, let me underline that again, because people lying to you on other channels will never say this, Over 70% of Americans support that constitutional right. It'll be swept away. But the president's not in this picture. The presidents who were outvoted in each one of those elections over the last three decades. Now, Americans will rightly conclude that their voices and their votes no longer matter. So what are the implications for the court, for the law, and for American democracy? Let's bring in historian John Meacham, and also former acting U.S. Solicitor General Neil Katyal. John, let me begin with you. And as Kissinger said, I think during Vietnam, perception is reality. Obviously, the perception for 70% of Americans waking up this morning is going to be most likely that this is an illegitimate decision by an illegitimate court.
Well, the crisis of trust in institutions has just become universal in a way that is pretty much the nightmare scenario if you believe in the ultimate efficacy of the constitutional order to produce a more perfect union. Right, to protect the Jeffersonian assertion of equality, to protect the rule of law. For all its imperfections, the system has been worth defending for 250 years. Right now, if this draft decision, if the court were to go this far, you will have, as you were just saying, an extraordinary number of Americans believing that the system, in fact, is not capable of delivering justice, is not capable of reflecting the popular will, even through the constitutional prism. And I think that, you know, one of the great questions of the era, the great question of the era, is, are you and I, are we in this decade, are we up to democracy? Are we commensurate to the task? And I'm worried that we're entering the darkest period of that test, because if you have any reservations about the system's capacity to deliver justice, they have just been affirmed.
Neil Katyal, again, this isn't actually terribly surprising based on the oral arguments we heard in the Dobbs back in December. But as Joe points out, poll after poll shows this is about a 30% position that the Supreme Court has taken. It doesn't obviously operate on polls. It operates on whether or not they believe this Roe versus Wade should be upheld, whether it's legal. But you've slept on this. You've read through most of the opinion or the draft opinion. What is your first blush reaction, first to the substance of it and second to this leak?
Honestly, I want to cry. I want to cry in so many different ways, but just to start with the substance of this decision, this is as full-throated and a muscular a decision as could ever be envisioned. And yes, after the oral argument, I think we all predicted Roe versus Wade was on thin ice. I think many thought it would be another year. For the last 3 years, I've been saying, given once Justice Barrett got on the court, Roe's days are numbered. But to see it in print, obviously it's only a draft opinion, but it sure looks like a real opinion. I mean, this is hard. This is not, it doesn't look like it's a deep fake or anything like that. He uses all of Justice Alito's kind of signature moves. So it really does feel legitimate. And what it means, just on abortion first, is that states can now pass laws with no rape or incest exception whatsoever prohibiting abortion, and those are now constitutional. The Supreme Court will not stand in their way. Congress can pass such a law outlawing abortion in the 50 states. The Supreme Court will not stand in its way. So that's on abortion. And then the reasoning of this decision is so, as I say, muscular, it could reach other rights as well, including the right of marriage equality, which is just recognized by the Supreme Court a few years ago. I mean, this is an opinion that Robert Bork would have written. This is not an opinion that most justices that have lived in our lifetimes would have written. And Robert Bork, of course, was rejected for the court because of these views.
This takes us right back, Jonathan Lemire, to the top of the show when John Meacham, presidential historian John Meacham, talked about the real problems with the way the Supreme Court has been handled by the Republican majority over the past five, six, 7 years. It's a might makes right approach. You actually had Republicans making up a Senate rule, a Senate custom, so they wouldn't have to even give Merrick Garland a hearing. You then had a couple of years later, well, that was at the end of Obama's term, so they could stop his selection. Then at the end of Trump's term, they threw that aside, further illegitimizing and politicizing the process. And now, yes, now they're saying, oh, well, we won't give Joe Biden a hearing, his nominee a hearing. So this is my concern, because I love the institution of the Supreme Court and what it's meant to Madisonian democracy through the years. It has been very disappointing, deeply troubling, because Republicans have so politicized this process that I fully expect Democrats, when they have the opportunity, to do what Washington did and what Adams did and what Jefferson did and what Andrew Jackson did and what Abraham Lincoln did and what Republicans did after Lincoln died, and change the size of the court. I mean, it's again, if precedent doesn't matter constitutionally, well, then certainly political precedent won't matter. So they'll just do what founding fathers and Abraham Lincoln and Andrew Jackson and Republicans after Lincoln's death did. They'll just expand the size of the court, because Republicans will be in no position to talk about them politicizing the court or undermining this process. You see, that's where they've led us. And then at that point, and this is something John Roberts knows, and I pray to God that it's something that Brett Kavanaugh understands. At that point, when the Supreme Court loses its legitimacy, I mean, my God, Madisonian democracy is undermined. Mm-hmm. And I say this, I mean, I say this regardless of my views on this particular issue. This is what the Republicans have done over the past 5, 6, 7 years regarding the Supreme Court has led us to this point where you actually now have, we've seen a draft, which we hear from Pete Williams is most likely going to end up being the net result, where the United States Supreme Court is going to overturn a constitutional right that has been in place for 50 years, supported by over 70% of the American people. That's not conservative. That is radical. It is dangerous, and it undermines what I believe is the institution that separates this constitutional republic and this Madisonian democracy, this form of government we have, from every other government on the globe. It's these are troubling.
This is consequential.
Joining me now is Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts. Senator, I think a lot of you channeled the way a lot of people have been feeling in response to this. This is why I was very excited to have you on the program tonight. It's 24 hours since the news broke. You were out in front of the steps. You are one of 100 people in this country that has a job as a United States Senator. What is your thinking right now about, as you process the last 24 hours, what the meaning of this is and what is next to be done?
Well, let's start with what the meaning of this is. This is the culmination of decades of work by the Republicans. They've gotten what they want, not a little chip away at Roe, but just blasting the whole thing apart. And I think we all need to think about who's going to be most affected by this. Who's going to bear the brunt of this? It's not going to be well-to-do women who can afford to get on an airplane and fly to another state, or shoot, could even fly to another country to get the abortion services they need. Now, who this is going to fall on is, this is going to fall on poor women. This is going to fall on Black women. This is going to fall on girls who have been molested
by someone in their family. This is going to fall on women who have been raped. This is going to fall on women who already are working two jobs and in order to try to support their children that they have. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones who will pay the price. Those are the ones who can't afford to take off work. Those are the ones who can't tell someone that they're pregnant until this has already gone way too far. Those are the ones who bear the cost of the privileged in the state legislatures and the privileged who sit on the United States Supreme Court and the privileged in the United States Congress who facilitate a rule that falls on them, a rule that says your dignity, your life, your future just doesn't matter.
Roe was decided in 1973, and prior to that, of course, there was a patchwork of laws across the country, and in some states it was illegal to obtain an abortion. You said today that you had seen firsthand what that's like, and I wonder if you, I mean, look, I was born after that date. A lot of people watching this probably haven't. It's, you know, a huge, it's been a fair amount of time. What does that mean when you say you've seen this firsthand?
I grew up in Oklahoma. I grew up at a time when abortion was unlawful. And that means there were women who bled to death from back alley abortions. It means there were women who ended their own lives rather than carry forward in a pregnancy that they could not bear. And that's the world that the Republican extremists are trying to recreate. And make no mistake about this. This is not one on which America is closely divided. This is not one that just in the last, you know, few months or even few years, we've all come together. For a long time now, it has been the case that the overwhelming majority of Americans, by a margin of more than 2-1, say that they want Roe versus Wade to continue to be the law of the land. And that's true. Red state, blue state, mm-hmm. young people, old people, Republicans and Democrats. That's why the plan of the extremists has always been not frontal assault on Roe through the legislative process, but to go to the Supreme Court and just keep pushing for a more and more and more extremist Supreme Court. And that is why the danger that this Supreme Court now poses is out in full view for everyone. They are willing not to try to couch this in hidden language, not to say a little now and then a little next year and then a little the year after that. They are willing to come in and just blast Roe versus Wade to pieces because they have the power to do it. Well, I got news for them. They can take away a woman's constitutional right, at least for a while, but the United States Congress can come roaring back and pass a law to protect and even do a better job of protecting anyone who needs or wants access to an abortion.
Let's talk about that. So there is, there are 50 United States Democrats, there's 50 Democrats in the Senate, there are 50 Republicans. Two of those Democrats, I think, have said they are opposed to the proposed law that's passed in the House that enshrined Roe. That's Bob Casey in Pennsylvania and Joe Manchin. So there's 48 votes. There are two Republicans who are ostensibly supporters of abortion rights, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. Susan Collins said this today: if this leaked draft opinion is the final decision and this reporting is accurate, it would be completely inconsistent with what Gorsuch and Kavanaugh said in their hearings and our meetings in my office. Obviously, we won't know each justice's decision and reasoning until the Supreme Court officially announces its opinion in this case. I guess the question is, like, yes, Congress could do it. And I've heard a lot of people, there's a lot of anger out there, and a lot of people saying that the Democrats send me a fundraising email about this, I'm going to lose my mind. Like, you have power. I need you to wield it. So what do you say to that?
So I say this. First of all, let's all acknowledge we do have the power to get this done. And so our first step is going to be next week. We're going to vote this in the United States Senate. And 50 votes plus the vice president, That should be enough to do what the people of the United States want us to do by a margin of more than 2-1. However, we're going to face the filibuster head on. And this is going to put it to everybody who tries to protect the filibuster one more time. We're going to run right into that, and we're going to have to address this question. The filibuster is not in the Constitution of the United States. The filibuster was used for decades and decades and decades to keep us from passing an anti-lynching law over 100 years. The filibuster was used to keep us from passing voting rights and the other civil rights laws. The filibuster has just been used this year to prevent us from protecting the vote all across this country. So I think part of this is going to be we're going to have that fight one more time around the filibuster. And look, I look at it this way. If we don't have enough Democrats to get that job done right now, then give us some more Democrats. And I actually want to put in a pitch right now for something everybody who's watching this can do today, not just, you know, on down the line, but right now today. There's about to be a primary down in Texas for a congressional seat. Henry Cuellar sits in that seat. He is someone who has supported the Texas abortion ban. He's someone who has voted against federal efforts to try to to protect Roe versus Wade at the federal level. And he's running against a young woman, Jessica Cisneros, who's terrific and who has a real chance to beat him and who will fight for a woman's right to make her own decisions about her life. So if you're mad when you listen to this, send Jessica Cisneros $10. If you can afford it, send her $25. If you can afford more, send more. But don't talk to me about how frustrated you are because you don't like our particular constellation of Democrats. Help us get some Democrats elected who will actually make a difference. I'm mad, I'm ready to take action, but we need this entire nation to speak out. If the vast majority of people in this country want to see Roe versus Wade protected, then it's going to take all of us working on this. And yeah, it may take a little patience, it may take some frustration, but that's how we get there. And believe me, this is a fight worth having.
With what is, you know, scoop of the ages here, go ahead and put this up on the screen. I'm going to take my time and go through a good bit of this so you just have the facts of what happened and what the decision, the draft decision here ultimately says. They say the Supreme Court has voted to strike down the landmark Roe versus Wade decision according to an initial draft majority opinion written by Justice Samuel Alito, circulated inside the court and obtained by Politico. The draft opinion is a full-throated, unflinching repudiation of the 1973 decision, which guaranteed federal constitutional protections of abortion rights, and a subsequent 92 decision, that's Planned Parenthood v. Casey, that largely maintained the right. Alito writes, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. So not mincing words here whatsoever. Part of what he writes in the document, he says, we hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. It is time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives. Now, they go on to say deliberations on controversial cases can be fluid. Justices can and sometimes do change their votes as draft opinions circulate, and major decisions can be subject to multiple drafts and vote trading, sometimes until just days before a decision is unveiled. The court's holding will not be final until it is published, likely in the next 2 months. I would say, though, it is very unlikely that the contours of what is happening here are ultimately going to change. They say the immediate impact of the ruling as drafted in February, that's the date that is on this draft that was leaked, would be to end a half-century guarantee of federal constitutional protection of abortion rights and allow each state to decide whether to restrict or ban abortion. It is unclear if there have been subsequent changes to the draft. Let me read you a little bit of the sort of, you know, the TLDR of this lengthy draft. Alito writes, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and the decision has had damaging consequences. And far from bringing about a national settlement of the abortion issue, Roe and Casey have inflamed debate and deepened division. Of course, I don't think that this decision is going to lessen debate or lessen divisions, but we'll put that aside. In terms of who is siding with the majority here, we know Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Alito, who drafted this decision. It's a little bit unsure what Chief Justice John Roberts is ultimately going to do. However, there is reporting that indicates he was going to dissent from the majority opinion and take kind of a middle ground, Sagar, which was, you know, this was all came about because of this Mississippi law that banned abortion after 15 weeks. So he was trying to find a way, and you could hear this in the oral arguments too, where he could uphold the Mississippi law and yet not strike down Roe entirely. And so even though, you know, it was very clear, the court is very conservative at this point, it's very clear that there has been decades worth of activism to get justices on the court for exactly this moment, there was a thought maybe they would pursue that middle ground of continuing to erode abortion rights, which has been the direction of the court for years and years now, but not actually go the full distance and overturn Roe. It looks like the only justice who will ultimately pursue that course here is likely Chief Justice John Roberts. So it really is an extraordinary moment. A couple more things within the legal reasoning here that are going to be major points of contention. Liberals are looking at this not just in terms of what it means for Roe, which obviously, you know, has extraordinary consequences. We'll get to some of that in just a moment, but also what it could mean for some other decisions which have been, you know, which have been taken by the court, which depend on some of the same legal rationale that Roe ultimately did. So they write in this political piece, liberal justices seem likely to take issue with Alito's assertion in the draft opinion that overturning Roe would not jeopardize other rights the courts have granted in privacy, such as the right to contraception, to engage in private consensual sexual activity, and to marry someone of the same sex. So in particular, liberals are concerned about the Obergefell ruling. That's the one that granted the right to same-sex marriages. There are others as well that sort of depended on some of the same legal rationale. So it truly is an extraordinary moment in how it happened, in when it happened, in what it means. And there is a lot to take in and a lot to process here today.
Yeah, there's no way around it. So I think we can at least say within that, so within the vote itself, we know then that that means that Justices Alito, Kavanaugh, Thomas, Barrett joined the decision. Now, obviously, and obviously Alito, since he's the person who, and of course, Justice Gorsuch as well, there were some questions on Justice Gorsuch given his ruling in the Bostock case, but that was more on a libertarian-minded view whenever it came to trans issues. So this one at least pushes that in that vein. In terms of Justice Roberts, like you said, we do have reporting. It's difficult, you know, in terms of people familiar with thinking and all this. We'll get to this in the leak section of our show, but, you know, relying on all of these reports and we don't actually know the vote actually makes it even harder. And another thing I would emphasize is this is a draft report. As you said, it is possible that things have moved around. So from a lot of the legal analyses that I have looked at and from my friends who are certain is that the vote is almost certainly not likely to change. However, it could be that the opinion and the scope of the opinion could change somewhat whenever it's eventually issued. So this was not expected until July. Now, there's also a lot of questions here about what exactly the court is going to do. They could come out today and just be like, okay, here's a majority opinion. They may, you know, the dissents and all that are still being written, but, you know, given the extraordinary leak of what's happened here, we're just going to go ahead and make this,
yeah,
which would make a settled law.
They have not responded or commented at all to this point.
Right. And that's another point where both pro-life people and people who are pro-choice are saying is like, hey, this is a draft opinion. You know, the law of the land is still what it is. So this does not affect current laws that are on the books. That being said, when it is issued, it will have a significant impact and definitely just change the scope of our politics. Puts up there on the screen. There are 21 states currently that have auto-trigger laws that either ban or restrict abortion if Roe versus Wade is overturned. So there are a lot of laws on the books, and I'll just go ahead and read these. Most would ban abortion with limited exceptions like medical emergencies or in the cases of rape or incest. Those are Arkansas, Idaho, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, and Utah. So those were all laws which were actually enacted mostly during the Trump administration as the ability. So that way the state legislatures would not have to meet in order to ban abortion if they wanted to. It was like an auto trigger law in the event of what happened with Roe versus Wade. Now there are other states which have some which will clear certain types of restrictions. So those states, trigger law states, would choose to immediately begin enforcement. other states would have a so-called phase-in period with the heartbeat laws that we've seen. So it's very, very different in terms of state by state.
Sure.
And then I believe others also have Oregon, Vermont, and the District of Columbia have it specifically enshrined all the way up until the point of birth. So that is just a clear kind of, now it's going to become a state issue, you know, if and when this does actually become the law of the land. And I think that people need to adjust how they're going to look at these types of politics, because it's just going to change. You know, the state legislatures themselves are going to become major flashpoints. And I think my question and your question as well is, like, how does this change the landscape in a state like a Pennsylvania, in a state like a Florida, in a state like what are some other purple states that are at Georgia, actually, is one that could possibly go more red as a result of this. We'll get to the politics.
Georgia actually has already, they have a very extreme ban already on the books starting at 6 weeks.
Right.
So 6 weeks after that, you're done. I mean, for any of you who have been pregnant before, you often don't even know till around 6 weeks. So, you know, Georgia now being a purple state, I think, yeah, that could probably push the state more in the direction of, you know, a hardening sort of suburban Democratic majority. But we'll get to a little bit more of that because we're going to delve into the politics here in a few minutes. You know, the reason why it's a little bit complex and you'll see slightly different numbers in different places about which states will effectively automatically ban or severely restrict abortion when this ruling does go into effect is because, you know, the laws are complex. So you have some states that it's just straight out, they, you know, passed a law that says if Roe gets overturned, we are automatically, these are called trigger bans, so we are automatically effectively ending the right to abortion in our state, period. You have some states, there's a new one added to the list since actually that article was even written, that's Florida, where they passed a law that was very similar, and DeSantis signed it into law, to the Mississippi law that was in front of the court. It is a 15-week ban with exceptions only for life of the mother, but not for rape or incest. You have some states that had, prior to Roe, an abortion ban that was already pre-existing and on the books, and then Roe went into effect and effectively nullified those laws, but the laws are still on the books. So, you know, for some of those are likely to come back into effect. As you pointed out, some places it will happen immediately. Some places there will be a phase-in over time. And I also think it's worth pointing out that because of the way that abortion rights have been the ground has already eroded under abortion rights over the past decades, you already have a number of red states where the right is already effectively gone. Texas is a good example. Kentucky, where I used to live, is a good example. You know, when I was there, I think there was one clinic that remained in the state. That clinic was constantly under assault from Republicans who tried to pass these laws that were like putting out all of these superfluous medical restrictions that weren't really necessary for the clinics, but made it impossible for them to continue to operate. So there are already a number of states where the right is already effectively gone. I read a New York Times analysis this morning that was pretty interesting in terms of estimating what the overall impact of overturning Roe is likely to be. And what they found is in Texas, after their new law went into effect, abortions dropped by about 10% because you had women who, you know, who had the means, at least who were able to travel across state lines. You had others who were able to get abortion pills in the mail. They estimate that this overturning of Roe would probably reduce abortions by about 14% because it's more sweeping in scope. They also point out, which I think is always important to remember, who is the most typical patient seeking an abortion, it's usually low-income women. So there is no doubt, just factually, that this ruling will overwhelmingly impact poor and working-class women, wealthy women in this country, pre-Roe, post-Roe, and after this new overturning of Roe happens, have always been able to get whatever care, whatever doctors, whatever access, whatever procedures they want to get. That will undoubtedly still be the case. It's poor and working-class women who will be affected by this. They are the typical abortion patients. And it's also worth pointing out here that the typical woman seeking an abortion is a mother who already has children. So listen, you know, my personal feelings on this, I am a mother. I know that there are people who watch this show who have any range of views on the issue.
Yeah.
I do think it's, you know, disingenuous to say that the moral issues involved are not complex or that there are not competing moral claims here. Personally, I have always felt that because it is a complex moral issue, the best thing, the best course for governments to take is to trust the women who are evaluating a very difficult landscape and making very difficult choices. So that's why I've always been pro-choice and why I do, you know, think that this decision ultimately will be really damaging for a lot of women out there. And the last thing I'll say on this, on my own personal opinion, is that if you do care, and I do, and I know probably all of you listening do as well, about reducing the number of abortions, because no one is like, yay, go abortion. Abortion is a wonderful thing. You know, you can look at the statistics and see that the vast majority of women who seek abortions are low income and see that if you deal with material conditions and you allow women to be able to support their children and their families and create an atmosphere of thriving, then you are going to have a very large effect in terms of reducing abortions. Yeah. So that's what I'll say about that.
It's funny, Crystal. You know, I've said previously I'd rather gouge my eyes out than talk about abortion, but I guess it's here. So cards on the table.
Yeah.
here it is. I grew up in evangelical Texas. Left a bit of a scar on me. I can just tell you personally, I consider myself a Barstool conservative. I'm culturally center-right whenever it comes to modern culture war issues, but I've always been safe, legal, and rare guy, basically a Democrat from the 1990s. I mean, what you just espoused is literally what Bill Clinton said on the 1992 Democratic nomination. I know that's going to piss off a lot of my Republican and Catholic friends here in Washington, but look, I mean, I think I owe it to the audience to tell people where I'm coming from. So if you are a person who is super pro-life and you're Catholic or evangelical or somebody else, or Orthodox Jewish, etc., I am not going to be your representative on this issue. And I just think it's important for people to understand where I'm coming from. I do think some of the histrionics on this are wrong. I mean, for example, what you were talking about, I know several states, New York, California, and elsewhere, are going to set up travel funds so that people who are in these places can travel mm-hmm. to those states. I think that's very likely to be, you know, the next frontier of like, well, a lot of abortion politics. But yeah, I mean, look, I mostly share your view on the entire thing. I'm pretty socially libertarian and have become so, especially over the last 2 years during the COVID pandemic. And, you know, whenever I look at this issue, I mostly trust people to do what they want for themselves. I do have a real moral aversion to like partial birth abortion and anything. You know, I was telling you there's a case here in Washington where there was some release photos of, you know, babies who were aborted when they were like 7 months old. And I was like, I'm sorry, you know, that's crazy. That's straight up murder. Now, you know, obviously, you know, the Catholics and the Christians are going to be like, well, life begins at conception. Listen, you know, I'm not religious. I don't share your view. I'm never going to. You're not going to convince me of it. I do want to respect, though, the people who feel that way. It's a free country. You know, you're allowed to believe what you would like. And I know this is the number one issue for a lot of the people who voted for Donald Trump. I do think, and we'll get to this in the row politics segment. Listen, I mean, this is going to have a significant impact on our public discourse. I would just ask you, try and engage it in the way that we're here. Crystal, you just gave an extraordinarily compelling case, in my opinion, on the pro-choice point of view. You could also see clearly why people might be able to dissent from it. Guys, if you are out there, please just spend some time engaging both with the people on both sides and try to understand that they are not like demonic and they don't want to destroy you, both on either side. Now, are there fringe elements? Like you said, are there people who like Lena Dunham who literally support and celebrate abortion? Yeah, you can find that, frankly, amongst all people.
Well, you can also find,
and that's what I'm saying,
people who bomb abortion clinics.
They're not just exactly
say I'm a murderer for what I just said.
That's right. You know, people will call me a murderer too. I already know that. You can see that, hear the screeching. I don't particularly care. But listen, those fringe elements exist on all sides of our debate. I would just say that, you know, let's all try to remember who we are. We've lived through much more contentious times in this country, and I know it's a difficult time for people. I personally felt, and I know this sounds crazy, I felt a sense of dread when I saw the news, because I was like, oh man, this is the last thing we need in terms of ripping us all apart. But I also know that there are a lot of Catholic moms and, you know, March for Life people out there. This is their number one issue. They've been trying for this for 40 years, and, you know, people have constituencies in this country, and it is what it is.
You can argue that this issue is maybe the most central issue to why Trump ultimately was elected.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah, right.
I mean, it was him putting Mike Pence on the ticket to shore up, to signal to evangelicals, like, I'm with you.
Yeah.
You know, you may not love my choices in life. And I know in the past he supported Planned Parenthood. I mean, he clearly like doesn't really care about the issue, but it doesn't matter what he personally feels, because ultimately he puts Pence on the ticket. He releases his list of Supreme Court justices. And in the wake of the fallout from the grabber by the pussy scandal, that really helped to shore up and bring home that Christian, you know, evangelical base for whom this has been an extremely animating issue for decades. So, and now that base is his hardest support. And to be quite honest, you know, a lot of times we talk about it doesn't make sense. You hear this analysis a lot, like, why do they love Donald Trump? This is why right here, because ultimately this was the issue, the number one issue that they were backing him for. And now it's actually happening. The last thing I want to say, and then we can move on to how this came out, which is also, you know, worth discussing and is also pretty extraordinary, is they write, Alito writes in this draft decision, "We do not pretend to know how our political system or society respond to today's decision overruling Roe and Casey. And even if we could foresee what will happen, we would have no authority to let that knowledge influence our decision. We can only do our job, which is to interpret the law, apply longstanding principles of stare decisis," I think that's how you say that, mm-hmm, "and decide this case accordingly. We therefore hold that the Constitution does not confer a right to abortion. Roe and Casey must be overruled, and the authority to regulate abortion must be returned to the people and their elected representatives." So Alito basically acknowledging here that this is going to be a shit show, that this is going to be trigger an incredibly tumultuous time in American politics, because, you know, for the majority of the country, we're going to get to the polls. Roe has been sort of settled law. It's accepted. It's, you know, very significant majority support. Now, Americans' views on abortion are kind of all over the place. It's complex. You know, Americans by and large are sort of moderate on how they feel about abortion rights. Most people don't think you should have the right all the way up till, you know, the date of birth. But they also don't support, you know, even in very red states, the heartbeat bills that would say the moment that there's a heartbeat, abortion is 100% banned. So, you know, this definitely puts the court on the side of a relatively extremist position here. And, you know, it's the first time where instead of just this sort of casual erosion of this right or other things that have been broadly viewed by a large number of people as social progress, where you have an actual clear, oh, the bending of the moral universe doesn't actually always arc towards justice.
Well, it depends how you look at it.
Right? Of course, yeah, but I'm saying in terms of the majority of the country,
sure,
based on the polling, right? This is a decision that by the majority of the country has been viewed as progress. For it to be then overturned, I do think that it is a real wake-up call for a lot of people that none of these things can ultimately be taken for granted. None of it is completely settled ground. And that's just my encouragement to you, wherever you fall on this issue or any other on the political spectrum, to not take for granted any privilege, benefit, right that you enjoy in this country. Any and all of it can be rolled back if you are disengaged, if you are apathetic, if you think that, you know, you don't want to get your hands dirty in politics, or if you think that you're, you know, too disgusted with the system, which I certainly understand and relate to ultimately get involved. So that's sort of the ruling. As I said at the beginning, you know, there is some outside chance that it could change between now and the month or 2 months from now when it ultimately is released and becomes law of the land. But I think that is very, very unlikely. And it seems incredibly, you know, almost certain that this is the direction the country's headed in.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go ahead and move on then to SCOTUS politics, because this, how this all came out is a crazy story in and of itself. As you said, basically scoop of the century there from Politico. And the overall analysis of how this is going to affect the court for decades to come really is not yet being grappled with. Put this up there on the screen. From SCOTUS blog, "The document leaked to Politico is almost certainly an authentic draft opinion by Justice Alito that reflects what he believes at least five members of the court have voted to support overruling Roe. But as Alito's draft, it does not reflect the comments or the reactions of other justices." So that is definitely something to keep in mind whenever you're looking at that. We don't yet know if you're going to have concurrences from Justice Thomas, concurrences from Justice Barrett and others that, you know, people should remember. they're not entirely familiar with the way that these things go, but there can usually be, you know, up to like 10 documents that are issued with different concurrences.
People can dissent
selective
specific
concurrence
pieces.
Right.
And
it can be hundreds of pages.
It is noteworthy the draft is from February. So
right.
It's
it could have changed.
It could have already changed. That's an important thing to note.
Right. Okay. And so then in terms of the leak itself, there's a lot of questions about this leak. Let's put this up there on the screen again from SCOTUS blog. It is impossible to overstate that the earthquake this will cause inside of the court. In terms of the destruction of trust amongst justices and staff, this leak is the gravest, most unforgivable sin. And what he means is that within the court itself, it is a longstanding precedent. You do not leak draft opinions because they get issued by the court itself whenever everything is ready. Because it is literally the law of the land, it can change markets, it can change the country. Obviously, this one is going to impact our politics dramatically. And so, as I understand it, having spoken now to some people who were on SCOTUS or familiar with the process for clerking, this is the cardinal sin. You are never allowed to leak, not only to reporters, but a draft opinion itself being circulated is like, that is a whole other realm. Now, we don't know the circumstances under which this was leaked, and I do think it is worth kind of understanding who the people who brought this to light are. So, the two reporters who published this at Politico, Josh Gernstein and Alex Ward. So, what's interesting about the two of them, because I actually knew Alex back in my Pentagon days, he's a national security reporter who used to work at Vox. Josh Gernstein is a legal expert. You and I are probably most familiar with him for his reporting on the FBI. So it's not that he's more familiar, again, with national security law. There are a lot of questions right now as to why exactly the person who broke probably, or the people who broke probably the biggest scoop of the last 20 years are not Adam Liptak, who is the New York Times correspondent, Nina Totenberg, the NPR Supreme Court. She may have been placed back off of leave for some ethical decisions. But anyway, Nina Totenberg, she's the previous person who ever actually reported and inside the Supreme Court. Jane Mayer over at The New Yorker. There are many reporters in this town who have been covering the court, frankly, know the justices, have dined with them, been to their parties, weddings, all kinds of stuff. The fact that they did not report this and get this is pretty extraordinary. It leads to a question also on the leak strategy. And this is another thing I want to spend a little bit of time on, which is that there is an overwhelming assumption right now that this leak came from a liberal member of the court, either a justice herself, himself, or a member of their staff. But there also is a prevailing opinion on the right, in right legal world, that this was actually leaked because this is the majority opinion that should have been and has now been kind of hammered away by Roberts or by Justice Kavanaugh, because we don't know what the internal one is. So, I mean, I don't really know what to think. One theory floating out there is that the reason Gernstein and Ward got it is because it's possible that the email system for the Supreme Court was hacked and by, like, within the national security realm.
I haven't seen that theory.
Yeah, so, like, there's one theory that this was actually a hack of their email servers and then it was leaked, you know, to people who would be familiar with those types of sources, possibly like the NSA. Once again, by the way, this is pure speculation.
That's interesting, though.
Number two is that this was a liberal justice. I would say the overwhelming kind of opinion is on that one. Number three
It seems like, to your point about who got the scoop, it does seem like if it was a liberal justice, it would go to Nina Totenberg. Yeah, or even like a Jeffrey Toobin or...
Exactly,
you know,
yeah, Jeffrey Toobin is another one. He's written entire books on the court. I mean, you know, the CNN, he was the first person who was on CNN.
What's his name at NBC, who's very
Pete Williams. Pete Williams.
You know, these are people who have direct personal relationships, tons of sources within the courts.
Right.
Yeah, listen, this is all pure conjecture, but I would think that if it was actually one of the liberal justices, that it would have come to one of those.
I would think so, too. Maybe they're trying to cover their tracks. Also, it's possible the justice had no idea. A member of the staff did it. Maybe they went to college with Alex or with Josh. You know, I mean, who knows? Like, how these all things play out. Also, I did see some criticism of Politico for publishing this story.
Oh, come on.
And I'm, Listen,
please.
If I had my hands on this, I'd hit publish the moment I know
that's
it's
silly.
Real. No matter what you think.
I can't believe anyone's even arguing
greatest
that.
Story of all time.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of national impact,
well,
it's crazy.
And especially, yeah. I'm sure it probably came from the same people who would be outraged that, you know, Twitter censored the Hunter Biden story and things
on.
Like
yeah.
that. It's like, all right, guys, we got to be consistent
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
I do think that, you know, it was wrong to censor the Hunter Biden story. Obviously, if you're Politico
yeah.
or any news organization,
you run
assault,
it.
You're going to run
There's
it.
There's no question.
I did
yeah.
think that, you know, there was a lot of conservative outrage about the fact of the leak itself. I just want to say, like, to me, the substance is way more important than the leak. I am not outraged about the leak. I view this listen, I have no respect for, like, the norms and guardrails of the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an undemocratic, unaccountable institution. I think it already kind of sucks. I think it's, you know, I think its norms suck, too, by the way. Like, they have this instinct towards a total lack of transparency and also towards a total lack, which we covered on this show, of any sort of ethical guardrails for their own justices, unlike other places within the judiciary, within the federal judiciary. So, you know, and again, it's the same type of people who during the Trump era would have been like, ah, the norms and guardrails, you guys stop with your pearl clutching, are now like, oh, how could you violate the sacred norms of the Supreme Court?
I get where they're coming from. I do think it's extraordinary. I think really whoever did this, you did us all a disservice. Because really, Crystal, and I agree with you, the substance is obviously most important.
Yeah.
There's a reason we led the show with that. That's not going to be my first take. My real thing is, guys, as people who we want to know the full picture, all we have is some draft opinion. We don't know the concurrence. We don't know what the law is. We don't know who voted against. We don't know what the full effect is. Okay, let's say that you're whoever leaked this is pro-choice. Well, listen, whoever you did this, you just put a lot of women in who are maybe there's a lady who doesn't go get an abortion right now. I mean, it's still the law. You can
or
if you
on
want
the other
to.
And there could be someone who says, "I better get this shit done
right."
Now.
Right, exactly. I mean, listen, it's extraordinarily likely that that's going to happen, right?
Of
I mean,
course.
You could go. I'm sure there's going to be planned lines down the block on Planned Parenthood here in Washington or many of the other liberal cities. So I just think that whoever did this really did us all a disservice.
I don't agree with that
yeah.
because I ultimately think the more information and the sooner the American people have that information, the better. I mean, we're also going to be talking about voting happening right now
yeah,
in critical political primary races that, you know, could very much be impacted by what looks extremely likely to occur in this case. So I totally disagree with that. Mm-hmm. I do actually think it was a service to have this information, to have the transparency around it, to have insight into their thinking. And, you know, I have no issue with I have no issue with whoever decided to leak this for whatever reason it was. And I think you're right to point out, like, there is sort of a working assumption that this was someone who was pro-choice,
mm-hmm.
who was upset about the direction of the decision, who wanted to try to put pressure somehow and like a Hail Mary pass to get somebody to bend under public pressure and go a different direction. I don't think that there is any chance that strategy is ultimately going to work. So basically, I think this just gives us insight earlier to where the court has ultimately landed on, you know, one of the central fault lines in American politics of the last 50 years.
I would just like to say on this, which is that it will destroy trust on the Supreme Court, and it will change the way that this works for all time. Because like I said, there is a pretty cordial relationship right now between, you know, like Justice Kagan is friends with, or Justice Ginsburg was really good friends with like Justice Scalia, and you know,
mm-hmm.
they used to go to conferences together, and Kagan is apparently close with Roberts, all this other stuff. Then that stuff is over in terms of sharing opinion. I know you don't care.
I don't really care about their decorum.
It could have a big impact though on all of us. I don't really know what that
would
look like.
I would personally be happy to see the trust and credibility of the Supreme Court go down.
Well, this is going to change.
So,
I mean, this is certainly going to polarize it. This is going to polarize it, no question, on the minds.
The other thing, I just wanted to point out some of the history here because you actually sent this morning, which is that there's no doubt that a premature leak of a decision is extraordinarily rare, but is not completely unprecedented. And actually, interestingly, when Roe was actually decided, there was a clerk for one of the justices who gave, I think it was Time Magazine, the jump on the story. And then, so the whole idea was, okay, I'm going to give you insight into what the decision is, but it's embargoed until the decision actually comes out. And because there was a delay in releasing the decision, Time actually, their magazine went to print and was on newsstands several hours before the decision actually came down and really sort of like screwed over this clerk who tendered his, he was like, I'll resign if you want. And I mean, the reporter, you know, and Time magazine really kind of screwed him over, because when you have an embargo, you have an embargo, and that's that. So that is an instance when it was leaked ahead of time and there was a jump on the story. It's obviously a little bit different than this situation where, you know, it's clearly an attempt by someone to inform the public early and potentially try to affect ultimately the outcome is whatever the outcome is here. Although, again, I think that is extremely almost, you know, impossibly unlikely to happen. But it is very rare for this ultimately to happen and does represent in its way also a sort of watershed breakdown in terms of, you know, how the court operates. Again, I have no problem with that, but that's just like the factual.
Right, it's a factual matter. It's going to change course of business there on the court. And, you know, that is something which is going to be interesting. Also, let's go put this next one up there on the screen, just people who are asking about the authenticity. Mm. Here's what Politico said in response. And it should also be notable. It's kind of like the Hunter Biden story where, look, you think the Supreme Court's not aware that it's out there? If it was fake, they would tell us.
They would tell us. They would have immediately shot it down.
They would have been like, this is a fake report. This is not. Actually, there's a good example of this. Recently, remember there was that story where people claimed that Sotomayor had to work from home because Justice Gorsuch wouldn't wear a mask?
Yes, that's right.
And they all put out statements being like, this is bullshit, that none of that happened. So we literally know that that happened. I think it happened like 3 or 4 months ago. So here's an example where been out there now. We're filming this. It's 8:47 a.m. here on the East Coast. Guarantee you all the justice has been up all night. If it was fake, they would have told us so. But in regards to that, the Politico says extensive review costs were confident of the authenticity of the draft. And again, pretty much everybody who is familiar with the court says that this is absolutely an authentic draft. So look, take that for what you will. Okay, let's move on to the politics of this, the most fun one. How do Americans feel about abortion? This is one which is going to disappoint a lot of my friends who are on the right. Let's put this up there on the screen. Public opinion on abortion has basically remained static since 1995, like I was talking about there back in the Safe, Legal, and Rare case.
Pretty interesting.
So right here in 1995, when this was taken, 60% of Americans said that they thought abortion should be legal in all or most cases. And in 2021, the last time that Pew did its extensive data, 59% said that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. Actually, the low point for abortion in this country was 2009, when Americans said 47% that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. I'm not exactly sure what was going on in 2009 or why exactly that would have changed, but it's not 2009. So there you go.
Obama is still party, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it could have been that. I truly have absolutely no idea. Now, in terms of views on abortion, how do most people feel whenever it comes to the trimester period? Because that really is where public opinion bifurcates completely. So, people who think that abortion should be legal in all cases, 25%. People who think that abortion should be legal in most cases, 34%. People who think that abortion should be illegal in most cases, 26%. People who think that abortion should be illegal in all cases, and of course, that is the rape, incest, life of the mother situation, 13%. Don't know, don't have an opinion, 2%. Wow, abortion really is one of those.
People know where they stand, apparently.
Knows exactly where they feel.
Yeah, I do want to just pause you on that, because I do think it's worth noting that of all of those positions across the spectrum that you just laid out, the least popular stance is illegal in all cases, only 13%. That's like lower than defund the police level of support.
Right.
And that is, in fact, going to be the law in quite a number of states, as we just went over. So that's why, you know, and especially when you ask people how they feel about Roe specifically being overturned, the latest poll that I saw, again, it was very lopsided, 70% wanted Roe to remain in place, and only 30% wanted it overturned. in general, my sort of like grand view of cultural issues like abortion is that whichever party seems to be in the most extreme position is the party that's losing.
Yeah.
And that's why I think you see the, you know, the little bit of ebbs and flows that you see in terms of where people stand on abortion, I think depends on those same swings in terms of what party is advocating for what. So now you have, you know, Republicans who are very responsive to the furthest right voices on this issue, because those are the people who are most activated on the issue.
Well, you know, they're single issue voters.
They're single issue voters. This is their thing. They're very organized. They're very activated on it. And so you have Republican elected officials who are very responsive to the furthest, hardest right views on this particular issue that has led them to be out of step with populations, even in conservative states. I think it was Mississippi that tried by ballot initiative to pass a fetal heartbeat law that got rejected even in a state as red as Mississippi. Of course, we had, you know, Todd Akin and his comments about legitimate rape in Missouri causing him to go down to a very unpopular Claire McCaskill at the time. So now you're going to have actually more pressure on Republicans to, you know, from this activist base to, okay, time to pass the law, time to make this the law in the state, if not the entire country. And that again is going to put them in a very extreme place, siding with 13% of the country that believe it should be illegal in all cases, versus the overwhelming majority opinion that says at least there should be some exceptions here.
So I actually have a polling here on Roe versus Wade, and actually this is one of the only cases where support has gone up for do not overturn. So in August of 1992, 60% said that do not overturn Roe, 34% said yes, 62% in January of 2003, January 13 remained static, but you saw a big jump in December of 2016. 69% yes, 28% say overturn. Now it is 70%, this is August of 2019, so roughly approximate to where we are right now. Do not overturn Roe versus Wade at 70%, yes, overturn Roe versus Wade at 28%. And the divide amongst Republicans is very real. So, and I want to spend some time here.
Yeah.
So total, people say that 61%, this is the divide amongst Republicans in views of legal abortion. Illegal in all or most cases, 38%. Legal in all or most cases, 61%. Now, amongst people who are Republican, 62% of Republicans say that it should be illegal in all or most cases, but 36% think it should be legal in all or most cases. Now, of people who identify as conservative, it's 77% illegal, 22% legal. Amongst moderate or liberal Republican, I don't know who calls it liberal Republican, but whatever, 44% illegal, 57% legal in all or most cases. Now, amongst Democrats, it's not nearly a split. 17% of Democrats say that it should be illegal in all or most cases and legal in most cases. Amongst conservative or moderate identified Democrats, it's 25% illegal, 75% legal. And amongst liberal Democrats, it's 9-91. So there's actually much bigger of a split within the Republican Party. And this is what I alluded to previously when I was describing my own views. I consider myself a Barstool conservative type. I'm very against political correctness. I'm very against some of these new, you know, culture war things that are happening with critical race theory and trans ideology. Those are frankly just as unpopular as banning abortion in all or most cases. Now you are going to see a big split amongst those people, Crystal. So what I was describing to you is that one third of Republicans, especially one third of people who voted for Donald Trump, consider themselves pro-choice. Now, they didn't care because Trump was ultimately against political correctness. And if you see also, we actually had a segment today we were going to do before all of this happened about how Republicans are leading amongst Latinos and amongst, I think it was parents under the age of
parents with young kids.
Parents with young kids, it's like 60%, something like that. Again, I would describe to the CRT and the trans debates. But when it comes to abortion, it's literally the opposite in terms of how that polling. And by putting this front and center as that, I do think this is going to be the one thing that could possibly change the outcome of the midterm elections. Now, there is evidence, possibly, against my hypothesis. We saw that the Texas law did not ultimately change that much. Governor Abbott is sailing to re-election. Now, Governor Youngkin here in, not in Virginia, but in Virginia, well, they ran a lot of ads against him saying he's going to overturn abortion of Roe versus Wade. That didn't ultimately happen. But Governor Newsom did run on it, And he ultimately beat the odds on the recall election. Not beat the odds. He beat, I think, is relatively the same margin.
His polls skyrocketed.
Right. His polls skyrocketed.
After the Texas law passed.
After the Texas law.
And it ended up not being close whatsoever.
Right. So what do you make of that? I literally have no idea. It was all been hypothetical. There are two sides of it. Personally, I think now that it's real and people have to really decide, and if it legitimately is on the ballot, I think this is going to hurt the Republican Party. I think red states will get a lot redder. A lot of the evangelicals are going to get a lot more excited. But places like Pennsylvania, places like Georgia, places like Florida, well, Florida is probably a little bit different. But let's say the industrial Midwest and elsewhere where the Barstool contingent is actually a lot higher. A lot of the people supporting the Republican Party are doing more so for cultural reasons outside of guns and abortion. That is going to have, I believe, a significant impact on their electoral chances come November.
Yes.
I could be completely wrong.
Well, I think, you know, you have said for a while that the one thing that could upend the current, you know, destruction of the Democratic Party that we were headed towards for the midterms would be that decision.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean it's going to play out that way, but it is that much of a sort of monumental pivot point in terms of the American political landscape that you could see it having massive impacts, especially because you have a Democratic base that has been completely apathetic. I mean, disappointed in Biden on almost every level. His economic agenda completely bogged down. You know, you pointed to trans issues and CRT with parents. I would point to the fact that you gave people a child tax credit and then you took it away after a year, which we saw there was a huge drop in terms of support from parents who were receiving the CTC once that ultimately went away. You have inflation. There's manifest many issues in which Democrats feel very disappointed in the failure of this administration to live up to their basic promises. Now, I think you are going to continue to see a lot of frustration among the Democratic base, especially the part of the Democratic base that cares most about the issue of abortion rights, that says, where have you all been? You know, we knew that this was a possibility. Mm-hmm. And I do want to make the point that, you know, Obama had a supermajority. The Biden administration has control of the presidency, the Senate, and the House. They got rid of the filibuster. They could enshrine abortion rights in law right now. It did not have to be left to this group of justices. And so as someone who is very upset with this decision and really abhors it, this is what I expect Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh and co. to ultimately do. The Democrats who claim to support these rights have had years and years and years to codify it into law and protect against the whims of an unelected, unaccountable Supreme Court, and they haven't done it. So I think that's very, very important to note. And I also want to say, because I mentioned earlier, that this is maybe the most central issue and a determining issue of why Trump got elected in 2016 when he puts out the list of Supreme Court justices, and that shores up the evangelical base. That was a huge turning point. You know, Hillary Clinton was at the Met Gala last night, at the Gilded Age-themed Met Gala last night, wearing her red ball gown with the names of, like, suffragettes and other women who inspire her. I don't know how she escapes any scrutiny and criticism from people who would be upset about this decision when she is the most proximate cause of the reason why we have these justices on the court. I mean, she ran a terrible campaign, not to mention her DNC allies who rigged the primary to put this terrible candidate as the, you know, standard bearer of the Democratic Party. So I think you also have to look at the Democratic leaders who have had every opportunity to shore up this right, which is important to not just their base, but a lot of people across the political spectrum. And they have made every excuse in the book, ultimately, not to act. So make sure you direct some of your ire today, if you are on the side of this issue that I am, at those failures across many years.
Well, there's also one Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who deserves a lot of scrutiny here,
which
I've always enjoyed. And this town is RBG Central. Literally where I used to live, there were RBG posters everywhere. Every liberal girl's got the RBG sweatshirt, bobblehead, mug. Some of them name their dogs and cats on Ruth. Listen, if you want to blame a single individual for this, who had agency over that, It's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, she is the person who refused to retire under Obama, and everybody was yes-queening her at the time because she wanted to be retire under Hillary Clinton, and then she ultimately died under Donald Trump, and it's her seat, which ultimately was the deciding vote in order to overturn abortion.
This looks to be a 5-4 decision.
Yeah, exactly.
One vote.
You're welcome, RBG. You know, like, I mean, seriously, like, anybody who is real about this needs to reconcile themselves with the fact that RBG's narcissism is the reason that this is happening if you are on that side of the issue, which is a little bit of a narrative violation, which I kind of enjoy.
Yeah, well, and I mean, listen, we don't love to speak ill of the dead, but those are just the facts.
She's a public figure.
Yeah, obviously.
Yes, or was.
Spoken ill of the dead. You have to be honest about people, whether they're alive or dead. And the honest fact of the matter is that if she makes a different choice, which many activists were encouraging her to do, this decision goes in a different way, and you likely have the continued sort of steady erosion. I do want to say, I feel like some of the conservative outrage at the fact of the leak versus the focus, you know, there's more of a focus on that from the right than on the substance of the decision, I think, in certain ways in terms of their outrage. I think that's a little bit telling, because if they felt like this was ultimately just an unambiguous great thing for them, then they'd be kind of cool with the leak. Like, for example, if Obergefell, which, you know, guaranteed the right to same-sex marriage, if that had been leaked ahead of time, I don't think liberals would have been, like, you know, apoplectic about the leak. They would have just been excited about the decision. So I do think it is a little bit of a tell that they also see this as probably very politically difficult for them. And the other piece that I'm frankly just not sure how it plays out is the organized effort among the evangelical right base to get justices on the Supreme Court to effectuate this particular outcome has been a central organizing principle of Republican politics for decades now. As I said, very significant contributor, if not the most significant contributor to Donald Trump ultimately getting elected. And so when you lose that animating factor, you know, maybe it doesn't really change anything, because now you still have the, well, we got to keep our people on there because we don't want it to, you know, go back the other way, or we got to make sure to elect Republicans in the legislature so they can enshrine this in law. But, you know, it's also possible that this is, which has been so animating, effectively being taken off the table for now, could also have a deflating impact on some of the animating politics of the Republican base ultimately. I don't know which way that goes, but it's going to be interesting to see how that ultimately all shakes out, Sagar.
There's no way to know. Like I said, I grew up around a lot of these people, a lot of these evangelicals. This is all they care about. This is all they've ever cared about. Here in the Northeast, we've got like a Catholic mom contingent. A lot of those people will crawl over broken glass in order to make sure that abortion gets overturned. So I don't know whether they're going to continue to come out and vote. If I had to guess, they're probably going to come out in big droves in order to support Trump, because he can run on "I'm the guy who got it done." Pretty big, you know, incentive. But in the long run, for organizing, for the church's support and the infrastructure that they've always given the socially conservative branch of the Republican Party, honestly, I really don't know. It's going to be interesting to me. It's possible that a human rights campaign phenomenon will happen. Like, you know, the human rights campaign here in D.C., they had all this money ahead of Obergefell. And then when it fell, they're like, well, now what do we do? Like, you know, so now they're all in on trans and all this other stuff may become dramatically more unpopular. But at the time, they had a real animating principle and they were a central force in our American politics. I mean, you'll remember in 2009 and 2010, I mean, they were huge in terms of their contingent.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Right.
Hey,
oh, my God.
Yes.
I mean, and now, you know, the Family Research Council, some of these evangelical concerned women of America, these are titanic forces on the right in terms of their endorsement power and more. It's possible that they lose. So they'll probably all pivot to, you know, CRT or gender ideology, possibly, but that's just, it doesn't have the same juice.
No, and it's and those very ephemeral issues. Like, well, I mean,
it's also not their lane, you know, it's not religious. So,
I mean, they got sort of spun up overnight and they could be replaced by some other moral panic or outrage in 3 days. But yeah, I think there's a couple things here. I mean, another story we were going to cover before this happened was the fact that Biden and the Democrats are like, I guess we're going to run on Trump again in the midterms. Yeah. So we'll just like try to make it about Trump again, even though we had the Glenn Youngkin race and we know this isn't really working for us anymore. I guess that's what we're going to do. And they were actually kind of like secretly glad that Elon Musk might let Trump back on Twitter because they view it the way we do. Of like, oh, good. We get this obnoxious asshole back that we get to point to every single day. Well, I think that thinking is all now completely off the table. This is going to be the midterm strategy for Democrats, and it's a potent one. I mean, in terms of motivating Democrats to come out and vote, in terms of where independents stand on the issue, and this is an issue where independents are very much more aligned with keeping Roe in place than with overturning Roe, and tend to be, you know, sort of in the center. And again, Republicans have placed themselves now in the camp of the most extreme view on the issue. So this is going to be potent, and it also does give, there is, I think, a genuine case that you can make that this does endanger things like Obergefell, because it does undercut some of the legal rationale and reasoning there. You do have Republicans, you know, sort of, yeah, they want to talk about trans issues, but there's also this whole effort to paint, you know, any gay teachers and whatever as groomers and the whole groomer discourse. So I don't think it's insane for Democrats to look and liberals to look at this decision and say, you know, some of these things that we thought were settled may not be so settled when we have a court that is clearly very activist, doesn't really care about precedent, even longstanding precedent, and is willing to cater to a conservative base, even when that means completely upending American politics. The other thing I'll say in terms of political impact is I think you're going to have a new group of voters who were not necessarily Bernie Sanders people who are completely disgusted with the failures of the Democratic Party. I think you'll have a lot of, you know,
EMC,
liberal women. Yeah. Who were maybe like Elizabeth Warren type people.
These are peak,
I mean, if you ever wanted to point clearly on a cultural issue to the utter failure of the Democratic Party across years and years, like, here it is. Because again, like I said, Obama had a supermajority, okay? Biden, who has talked about enshrining, you know, Roe in law effectively at the federal law, federal level, which you could do, has done nothing on it, has not been interested in getting rid of the filibuster or even, you know, changing or amending the filibuster. And so I think this is going to be a very compelling case for a group of voters who has been just sort of like vote blue no matter who, that the Democratic Party has failed in some really clear and really manifest ways. And that ultimately, even though, again, in the midterms, I think this will probably serve the Democratic Party and galvanize a base that has been extraordinarily apathetic, give them an issue to run on that where they are in the clear majority. I do think overall for the Democratic establishment, this lays very bare how just absurdly pathetic they have been in terms of standing for and protecting the things that they claim to care about and that they run on every election cycle.
Yeah, I think that's that in the decision, Alito actually does say Obergefell is protected law. So I think it's scary. You can say he's lying if you want to. I'm just, you know, I don't think there is any current political constituency to overturn Obergefell. 55% of Republicans support the decision. There is not even close to the same level of evangelical
We just pointed out that, you know, this is even goes against a significant portion of the Republican base.
Yeah,
so I don't put it completely off the table. I think it's going to happen tomorrow? No. But do I put it completely off the table? No, because I think you do have a court that is, you know, quite activist and quite unconcerned with past
problems. I could be wrong. I don't think that that's the next battle of the culture. However, the other issue, which you mentioned, which is important, is on the Democratic row. So I actually went ahead and polled. So for the first time, this year, actually, the Senate voted on Roe versus Wade. And there was an argument I saw advanced by Senator Sanders that they should break the filibuster. But by my count, the Democrats do not have the vote. So this was February 28, 2022. There were 46 yays in order to protect Roe, 48 nays, and 6 not voting. Now, the people who were not voting, notably Raphael Warnock, so he's come out on the record as pro-choice. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it would be a tough vote for him in Georgia. Another one is Senator Paul in Kentucky. I believe he is pro-life. Another one was Senator Lujan, New Mexico. He was, I believe he was ill at the time. But here is one which was interesting. Senator Kennedy of Louisiana. Mm-hmm. But most importantly was Senator Casey actually out of Pennsylvania. So apparently, and then Joe Manchin as well in terms of voting nay on that decision. So those different senators and how they fall. Right, go ahead.
Where are Collins and Murkowski on that count?
Right, so okay, let's go ahead.
Because
Collins was a nay on that vote. And then let me see here. Murkowski was also a nay.
So you do have a couple of Republicans who, you know,
that's a good point though.
Because Manchin says he's pro-life.
Right.
He would probably, you know, vote against Roe being codified in federal law. But Collins and Murkowski at least claim to be pro-choice.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, you know, Collins famously said that she didn't think Brett Kavanaugh would overturn Roe versus Wade. Okay, how did that work out for you? Like, that
was
clearly.
I think that was a pre-election.
Clearly not the case.
I had
it was definitely
last
pre-election
term there.
But so I think, you know, if you lost a couple Democrats, there might be a couple Republicans you could ultimately pick up. And then the other side of this is if Republicans do take control of Congress, and I think we have C3 that we can put up here, this Forbes tear sheet, there is an organized effort to try to push a law that would ban abortion nationwide if Supreme Court it overturns Roe versus Wade. You've got leading anti-abortion groups and their allies in Congress meeting behind the scenes to plant a national strategy that would kick in if the Supreme Court rolls back abortion rights this summer, including a push for a strict nationwide ban on the procedure if Republicans retake power in Washington. Now, I don't know whether you have, first of all, I would say, as I said before, the Republican Party, very responsive to this group of activists because they're very organized, because they're single-issue voters, because they're very much like, you know, they're very much a part, a core part of the Republican activist base. And so even in states where something like this would be pretty unpopular, you're going to see senators who back it and members of Congress who back it because of their responsiveness to that, you know, more extreme views of the Republican base on this issue. Now, do I think it ultimately would have enough votes? I don't know. But in terms of the politics for the midterms, it really doesn't matter because there's a very...
Yeah, you can run on it.
There's everything you need here to make a very credible case that they would want to head in this direction. So, you know, Democrats can say to voters in California, New York, other states, blue states, where, you know, these laws aren't going to be impacted by Roe versus Wade being overturned, like, you know, you shouldn't feel so safe here ultimately, because Republicans are not content with just half of the states having abortion effectively banned or extremely severely restricted. They're actually coming for the whole thing. And I also think these senators and members of Congress will be under tremendous pressure from the activist evangelical right to pass a measure such as this, because now it's like, okay, Supreme Court has done their part. Where are you on this issue that you've been telling us is core to your belief system for years? So they will be under pressure to pass and codify something like a nationwide ban.
Don't underestimate the Catholic Church either. They're going to go full bore on this one. They have a lot of power here in Washington and over a lot of the Northeastern, you know, Republican types as well. So, yeah, look, I think the TLDR from this whole segment is it's going to change politics forever. This is the one thing that could possibly rescue the Democrats. It will scramble a lot of the way that we talk and we debate for a long time. Like you said, it could activate the PMC kind of liberal contingent and against the Democratic Party, which definitely could be interesting. It could also change the way that Biden and the Democrats and Chuck Schumer run the Senate. It's going to change possibly the way that they'll try and get something through the House. So buckle up, get ready. It's a whole new era.
So I did let that run long. And I let it run long because the analysis was actually so erudite and concrete and nuanced that I actually listened to that three times today when I kept trying to suss this all out. Because to be quite honest, and this is me putting all my cards on the table, I have a very different opinion and then most of the analysis that we have heard currently. I pride myself on this show to be non-tribal, to present both sides of the argument, to give both of them a good run about where I find hypocrisy and corruption, so on and so forth. I like Sager, and I don't think a lot of people know this, but I'll spill the beans on this. Me and Sager actually share the same birthday. I'm just a bit older than him. But I have the same baggage when it comes to this abortion thing. Okay? He got his baggage from evangelicalism in Texas. I got mine from the Calvinist movement in Jacksonville, Florida, the Reform movement in Jacksonville, Florida. And a lot of that sticks deeply with the way that I think about this issue, not only on a metaphysical level, but also on a personal level. Okay? This is my personal bias. Okay? And I think that my personal bias is both justified and I think it's well reasoned. And anybody who has been in a situation that I have been in, where I have lost a child, I have a personal disdain for what I think sometimes is the cavalier and unthoughtful way that abortion happens in the United States of America. Let me be very clear on what I think about this. If you are a person who has the proximity to be very close to financial security, if you are in the middle class or in the upper middle class, are you in the top 10%, 5%, let's say the 1%. These laws will not affect you. 23 states will effectively, if these laws go into place, 23 states will effectively ban abortions. And if you have access to capital, you will still be able to do what you'd like to do to your body. Okay? But that all being said, I feel like that access to contraceptives are very different than it was 50 years ago. Access to condoms are very different than they were 50 years ago. Access to the day after pill is very different than when it was 50 years ago. Access to every technical advance to know what's happening is very different than what it used to be 50 years ago. And I think that this is of people trying to take the responsibility from themselves. Because this is a very monumental decision. Okay? I think that 6 weeks is unreasonable. And I will give you that. I think 15 weeks is reasonable. And that is just me. I don't think you need 4 months to make the decision, 5 months to make the decision, 6 months to make the decision, 7 months to make the decision. I think that that is an absolute immoral choice. I am 100% across the board pro-life. And I take that position with much trepidation, but much thought as well. If you lay down with somebody consensually and have sex, you have made a choice. You made a choice to meet them, to take them home, to lay down, to not wear protection, to not get the morning after pill, and to bring a life to the world. If there is a mechanism to where, or a situation, I think would be a better term, where you were raped, I think that's a very different situation, and I think then you should be given the choices that are available. if there's incest, I think for the health of the mother and the child, then that is something where the situation is vastly different. It is a corruption of the very notion of nature. It is a corruption of everything we consider to be love, and it is a corruption of even biblical or spiritual principles. So I find that termination as something that is something we will have to accept whether I like it or not. Okay? But I think that we have to be honest that viability has changed from over 50 years ago, and so has everything else. And these questions may need to be relooked at. We could say, to the end of the age, it is a private family matter, and we can say that. But every private family matter that I have ever known of has still been, in some way, shape, or form, regulated by the state. And this is no different. So this is one of those situations where I have to carry two different set of books. I think this issue is very complicated and very nuanced and very sad for a lot of people. I do not trust institutions enough to be able to make these type of concrete decisions. So I think that for that reason, and it should be left up to the individuals who have to make these tough decisions and who have to live with them. But as for me, and in my own house, this is a decision that I embraced when I heard it with a bit of joy. I don't believe in the state's right to kill its individuals. And I mean that when it comes to the death penalty. I fundamentally believe in redemption, and I don't think there's anything that anybody should do that gives the state the right, the opinion, the inherent right to say, we get to murder you. I have never and will never give the government the permission to kill its own citizens just because they were born here. I don't agree with that. I don't agree with the draft. To where the one life you get to have, the government gets to decide, we have a policy, we have resources that we think need to be fought for, and we have arbitrarily decided that you and you and you and you go fight and die. I don't believe that. I don't think the state has that right. I don't think the state has a right to take a life. I don't think the state has the right to coerce you to go give your life. And in that very same principle, which I feel is a moral consistency, I don't think the state has the right to tell you that you can stop the life of a newborn coming into the world. I don't think the state has that right and has that power. And because I live in a secular society, and I fundamentally agree with the Virginia Statutes of Religious Freedom, which gave us the separations of church and state, which was the foundational documents that Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Virginia Statutes of Religious Freedom that led to the separation of church and state. I accept that I live in a secular society, and so the secular society will make decisions. But I do think this is a very complicated decision. I don't think it's a concrete as people want it to be. I think a lot of the arguments that Alito made when he connected the Roe v. Wade decision to race decisions was sound. Just because something is legal does not mean it is correct. And remember, Dr. Martin Luther King reminded us years ago the Holocaust was legal, slavery was legal. Do not confuse legality with morality. This is a very, very difficult situation. And I don't want us to think about it in these purely partisan political terms, because this is a very personal decision to me, and it's a very personal decision to people who have to make this decision. This is a very personal decision to families that have to do this. This is a very personal decision to people who have to do it because they were raped by family members or people or strangers who have to carry that sadness and what they see as sin and shame. This is a very personal decision for people who decide to carry their children to term and then put them up for adoption, knowing full well that the people who claim to be pro-life won't adopt. So I want to think about it like that. I think that there was a lot of good points made. I think this could have been avoided if, when Barack Obama was president and he had a supermajority, he would have used the power, like Mitch McConnell uses power, and had Senator Harry Reid 100% just do away with the filibuster for Supreme Court nominations. If Barack Obama would have asked Harry Reid to do it, Harry Reid would have done it. Harry Reid was a quieter version of Mitch McConnell, who knew how to wield power well, and you could see that in all the federal landmarks that have been labeled in Nevada, and most of those have been labeled there as federal property just because Harry Reid, the late Harry Reid, did that. Okay? If Barack Obama would have asked Harry Reid to gut the filibuster, Harry Reid would have done it. If he would have asked him to gut it just for the filibuster, he would have done it. And if I think it's correct, if liberals would have pushed liberal hero, the notorious RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, to retire, we would not be in this situation. But here we are. If Democrats would have pushed more seats on the federal bench, you wouldn't have had to have Mitch McConnell sitting around saying that Gorsuch couldn't even, that Merrick Garland would not even get a nomination. A federal judge didn't, you know, he didn't even get a hearing. Well, so I think that the liberals like to pretend that they're the smartest people in the room, that they're the most educated, that they're the most tactical, that they're the most strategic, but they lost to Mitch McConnell. And here we stand. So I have told you my position on this particular topic. I can talk about the politics and the ramifications and the fallout and what this may mean. And I think that this may just be a topic that I have beat a dead horse with, okay? So, I'm going to do something in a blast from the intellectual past that I don't normally do. And I'm going to play a clip in regards to this topic from a perspective that we don't normally hear on this show. My own personal spiritual beliefs on this particular issue. You have every right to decide for yourself. That is your right. This is a very scary issue because I think about other rights that may be cut down. And that is very scary to me because I do not trust institutions. I do not trust, I don't think the people that are making a lot of the arguments and making arguments in good faith. But this is a very difficult one for me personally. And the show has run very long because this has been a very important topic. And this will continue to be a very important topic. I want to hear your perspective on this. And as I disagree with you with dignity and respect, I would like you to disagree with me in kind. You are my countryman no matter what. And we will get through this together. I'm going to go through a blast from the intellectual past. And I will see you on the next episode where we go through more domestic issues, international topics. And here I stand. I can do no other. God help me.
It's a magnificent thing. The only newly originating life in the universe that comes in the image of God is man. The only newly originating life in the universe that lasts forever is man. This is an awesome thing. And as everyone knows, that reverence is not shared by our new president, over whom we have rejoiced. He is trapped and blind in a culture of deceit. And on the 36th anniversary of Roe v. Wade last Thursday, he released this statement. We are reminded that this decision not only protects women's health and reproductive freedom, but stands for a broader principle that government should not intrude on our most private family matters. To which I say, no, Mr. President. You are not protecting women. You are authorizing the destruction of 500,000 little women every year. No, Mr. President, you are not protecting reproductive freedom. You are authorizing the destruction of freedom for 1 million little human beings every year. No, Mr. President, killing our children is killing our children, no matter how many times you say it is a private family matter. You may say it is a private family matter over and over and over, and still they are dead. And we killed them, and you would have it remain legal. Mr. President, some of us wept for joy at your inauguration. And we pledge that we will pray for you. We have hope in our sovereign God.
So, what you just heard was Dr. John Piper, from when Barack Obama made his statement about Roe v. Wade, and that will sit as our blast from our intellectual past, and that'll be the end of the show today. And thank you for tuning in, and as always, I love you, thank you for your support, and I will see you on the next episode. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for as little as $3 a month. Again, that's www.patreon.com/The Darrell McLean Show. Yeah. The Daron McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. Get a membership and support independent media at www.patreon.com/The Daron McClain Show.